The church won the 2004 elections, and don't let anybody tell you differently. It was that faith in values, that believing church inside this room and millions outside this room who were strong enough to offset all that Hollywood and the liberal media and Michael Moore and George Soros could do to prevent the re-election of George Bush.
Jerry Falwell's voice, of course, that was shortly after the 2004 elections. We talked about it at the time. Well, with his death, some people are using the term, many people are using the phrase, changing of the guard. We're going to talk about the legacy of Jerry Falwell with John Green, Senior Fellow in Religion and American Politics for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, based in Washington, D.C. You can join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio this Thursday, the 17th of May, issues ETC. At KFUO.org. After this short conversation with John Green, Dr. James Berkey will join us to talk about the Republican Democratic presidential candidates one by one. John, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be with you.
You've used the phrase changing of the guard, and I've heard it probably more in the last 2 days than in my whole life. Is the death of Jerry Falwell a changing of the guard?
Well, you know, in many respects, it's a symbol for that kind of change, which was already underway. And without, you know, being morbid about this, the leadership of the first generation of conservative Christians who became involved in politics is aging. And as these things usually take place, new leaders will take their place in due time. And this, as I indicated, this trend was already underway. But I think the death of Reverend Falwell simply reminds us that process is ongoing.
How would you reflect upon the stature, in particular in public and political life, of Jerry Falwell?
Well, I think Jerry Falwell is a very important figure, both as a religious leader and the founder of a Christian college and a very prominent church in Virginia, but also as a political leader. And I think he's going to be remembered in both ways. People outside of the Christian community probably will remember him more for his political role and the founding of the Moral Majority in 1979 and the impact that he had in getting conservative Christians, and in fact Christians of all kinds, involved in politics in the 1980s, a process that, of course, has continued down to today.
You have written that Jerry Falwell, in many ways, among others, changed the way evangelicals think about political activity. What do you mean?
Well, you know, when Jerry Falwell came around and it came to politics in the late 1970s, among many evangelicals, there was a belief that Christians should not be involved in politics, that either that politics was a corrupt process that good people shouldn't be involved in, or that Christians should focus exclusively on religious or spiritual matters. And in fact, Reverend Falwell himself had felt that way earlier in his career, but he came to the conclusion that the issues that were at stake in the late 1970s and since then, questions such as abortion and marriage, were such that there was a moral imperative for Christians to become involved in the political process and to make sure that their point of view was heard. And he met with an enormous amount of resistance among evangelicals when he first made that argument. He made a second argument, which was that evangelicals and other Christians ought to cooperate with each other and indeed with people of other faiths if there was a common set of political values, and that they didn't necessarily have to agree completely on theology or on religious questions. And that, too, was a pretty amazing idea in the late 1970s. You know, today that's largely taken for granted, and not just among evangelicals, but in the population as a whole. So Reverend Falwell had a real impact in changing the way that evangelicals think about political activity.
What events or circumstances brought about the prominence of Jerry Falwell as a religious and political figure?
You know, I think probably the most important thing from a political point of view were the changes in the law in the 1970s. Foremost among them was the legalization of abortion with the Roe versus Wade decision by the Supreme Court. But there were a number of other issues that came along, including things dealing with the tax-exempt status religious institutions. And if you put all those things together, they suggested to Reverend Falwell and to, in fact, a number of other people that it was important for conservative Christians to express their point of view in the political process, with the understanding that they weren't necessarily always going to get their way, but they needed to take advantage of the democratic process, something that they really hadn't done in previous decades.
This morning I heard a roundtable that you actually participated in, along, among others, with Dr. Richard Land. And Dr. Land made a statement in the course of that interview where he said, had it not been for the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, there probably would not have been the rise of a prominent figure like Jerry Falwell in his capacity, the rise of the former moral majority, or even the present-day influence of evangelicalism as a voting bloc. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think Dr. Land was very correct about that. Evangelicals and other conservative Christians have many complaints about American society. Indeed, of course, a lot of Americans have complaints about our society. That's one of the virtues of living in a democratic society, is we get to complain. But I think the abortion issue rises above all of the rest, because it struck so close home to the values of Christians, the respect for life, the importance of the family, the importance of children, that it really did mobilize people in a way that maybe some of the other issues did not. The only thing I can think of that could parallel the abortion issue is the question of same-sex marriage. And of course, that eventually has come on the political agenda. But after evangelicals and other conservative Christians had already been involved in politics.
John Green is our guest. He's Senior Fellow in Religion and American Politics for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, based in D.C. We're talking about the legacy of the late Jerry Falwell. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So from its beginnings, if you will, in the late 70s, early 80s, until now, with the death of Jerry Falwell, how has the so-called Christian right changed?
Well, it's changed in a couple of different ways. First of all, it's changed in that the basic issues that were at stake in the 1970s and the 1980s, namely whether conservative Christians would be involved in the political process in large numbers, has largely been resolved. The evangelicals, for instance, voted about the same rates as other Americans, and in many contests they voted higher rates. They're very attentive to political issues, very interested in these sorts of questions. So in a sense, the world is very different because those questions have been resolved. Jerry Falwell felt that the moral majority had served its purposes, he disbanded it in 1989, and there were some organizations that followed on its heels. One of them was the Christian Coalition, which is still around in a little bit different form than maybe it was in the 1990s. Figures such as James Dobson, of Focus on the Family, began to take, in recent times, a real interest in these sorts of issues and have become involved in politics. And there's a whole variety of state and local organizations that have followed in the footsteps of the moral majority. We've had quite a degree of activism on the part of conservative Christians. And it may very well be that in the future that activism will change again, that we'll have new organizations and new leaders that may lead the movement in a little bit different direction. And so, and that's one of the reasons that it's useful to reflect on Jerry Falwell's legacy and to maybe think ahead of what the next leaders might be among conservative Christians.
A name that is often uttered in the same breath with that of Jerry Falwell is the name Pat Robertson. First of all, how would you distinguish between Robertson and Falwell? And then what does the death of Falwell mean for Pat Robertson as a political influence in the U.S.?
Well, let me answer your second question first. Pat Robertson is of the same generation as Jerry Falwell, and I'm sure that he is aware that he may pass from the scene eventually, perhaps sooner rather than later. And I'm sure that's something that Reverend Robertson reflects upon in his private life, but also in his public ministry. Pat Robertson had a little bit different approach to politics. He ran for president in 1988, and even though he didn't succeed in getting the Republican presidential nomination, he did much better than a lot of people would expect and discovered that organizing the evangelical vote and other conservative Christians was something that could be very productive. And I'm sure he was disappointed with his loss in 1988 in the primaries, but he put that to good use, from his perspective, by building the Christian Coalition, which was quite an effective organization in the 1990s. And it took the activities of the Moral Majority a step further and actually built a very successful grassroots program that elected quite a few candidates to Congress, as well as to state and local offices. Some people would argue the Christian Coalition may, in some sense, have passed its prime. Others might dispute that. But in recent times, with the advent of the question of same-sex marriage, the mantle has passed on to yet other leaders. And Reverend Robertson has taken a little bit of a backseat to politics, focused more on his television ministry and on his university, a bit like Jerry Falwell did after the Moral Majority was disbanded. So Robertson is a very important figure in this story, but played a somewhat different role.
So who is, I guess we shouldn't say heir apparent, now it would be heir, who is the heir to Falwell's legacy?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and journalists have been asking me that for the last couple of days, and you know, I don't really know the answer. It could be that someone else will rise up that will have similar stature to Falwell or Robertson or James Dobson in the future. That person is probably already out in the community doing things, but has not attracted a lot of attention yet. It may be that in the future there isn't a handful of very prominent leaders. It may be that there'll be a lot of different leaders, given that evangelicals and other Christian conservatives are very involved in the political process and involved in different ways. It could be that some of the younger leaders that are on the scene may rise to take a place. For instance, Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council is sometimes mentioned as a possible successor. Some people look to Joel Hunter, who is a pastor of a large church in Florida. Others look to Rod Parsley, a rising evangelist in Ohio. So there are a number of different people out there. No doubt I've missed a lot of important names, but who might have the opportunity to play this kind of role?
It strikes me that one of the things that Jerry Falwell did, either intentionally or unintentionally, I will guess more often than not unintentionally, was act or function as a lightning rod. And I'm not talking here about the controversial statements so much as the one who kind of took the hits for the masses of people whom he represented, but many people saying, well, you know, I got to agree with what he says. But he was the guy who was always, at least in the media, often taking the hits for what many in the Moral Majority and then later in kind of the general evangelical voting bloc believed themselves. What do you think, John?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that especially after the Moral Majority was disbanded, Reverend Falwell became in many ways a spokesperson for the broader concerns of evangelicals and other conservative Christians. And in that respect, I think he served a very important function to have that particular voice in the public square. He was a very genial man, very easy to get along with, even though he could be a little tough in the rough and tumble of politics, and sometimes said very controversial things. He was the kind of person that could engage in a civil discussion with people that had a very different view of the issues than he did. You mentioned controversies. He had no shortage of controversies. I suspect that some of them would have occurred anyway, because there are real divisions in this country over important issues and deeply held values. I suspect that sometimes he misspoke himself. People who are in public life often do that, particularly if they're talking on a regular basis. Believe it or not, that's even happened to me, and I'm just an academic. But I think sometimes maybe he also encouraged a little bit of controversy because he wanted to get attention for the issues that he cared about so deeply.
It's been pointed out that he came from a fundamentalist background that would have been, at the time, a politically quietist background. You mentioned that before. but that he rose to prominence speaking for the broad swath of American evangelicalism. Has one of his legacies been to kind of permanently blur the line that used to exist between fundamentalist and evangelical?
Yes, I think in many ways he did. Jerry Falwell always referred to himself as a fundamentalist. That was his background. That's where his beliefs were. But he developed this idea that people of different religious perspectives ought to be able to work together if they had common goals. And so in that sense, he was a unifier, and he did blur some of these religious distinctions as they pertain to public life. Now, in religious circles, so some of these distinctions, of course, still exist and still matters. But some of the hostility that had existed within the evangelical community between fundamentalists and others, and even between evangelicals and people of other religious backgrounds, have been blurred a bit. And there's a bit of an irony here. Jerry Falwell is often seen as a divisive figure. And in some quarters, he certainly was. But in other respects, he was a unifier, and he brought together people who had theological differences that in the prior to his political efforts had not been able to work together.
John, when we last talked to you, it was right after the midterm elections, and you had mentioned that Roman Catholic voters played a bigger role in the outcome of those elections than evangelicals did, and the real shift occurred among those voters. Do the media give too much credit and blame to evangelicals on the outcome of political elections?
You know, often, reporters look for a very simple story, and I can certainly understand that, but they often don't recognize that America is a very diverse country in religious terms, a very religious country, but one with many different kinds of religious people, and that there's not just one particular group that always has the same impact. It often varies from election to election. And, you know, the Roman Catholic community is divided politically. As we discussed the last time I was on the program, many Catholics are swing voters and can go one way or another. And so they play a particular kind of role in elections. At the moment, evangelicals are pretty strongly Republican, and as long as the social issues are prominent, I think we'll remain that way. And so they play a different kind of role, and one that is not often recognized by the media.
I noticed recently, and it came up around the issue of global warming, when the last time I think Jerry Falwell really made headlines and the nightly news was when he made some statements from Thomas Rowe Baptist Church on the issues of global warming. He preached a sermon there that got circulated pretty widely. And he was, in some way, staking out territory vis-a-vis other evangelicals, other allies on other issues there. What do you think was going on at that time, which was what is now becoming another concern of evangelicals, and that is the environment?
Well, I think that many evangelicals are paying more attention to the environment. And in the particular sermon that you mentioned, Jerry Falwell certainly was paying attention to it as well, even though perhaps he had a different perspective than some other evangelical leaders. So it's an issue that's coming to a lot of people's attention. But, you know, beyond that, I think there is a debate in the broader evangelical community about priorities. Should evangelicals focus their concerns, as they have in the past couple of decades, on the social issues, abortion, marriage, and so forth, or should they add to those issues some other concerns, such as climate change or some of the foreign policy issues and so forth? And there's a pretty heated debate going on about that. Some people believe that if evangelicals don't broaden their agenda, they'll miss an opportunity to bring their values to bear on very important issues. Other people believe, however, that if the agenda is broadened, that evangelicals will risk diluting their efforts and maybe have less influence overall. I don't know who's right, and I don't know how this will be resolved, but I think that's a very important debate, and I think Reverend Falwell was weighing in on that debate in that sermon. He wanted his voice to be heard in the process. And, of course, there are other evangelical leaders who take a different position. In the long run, I think that's very healthy, to have this kind of debate within a religious community as within the country as a whole, because then people get a chance to make up their own minds.
Could it be that actually the evangelical movement as a political force is actually finding itself moving toward where that other block of voters, Roman Catholic voters, have been for a long time, and that is quite agreed on a number of issues, but broad in their concerns, so broad that they have remained, they really don't have any fears of remaining relevant as a voting bloc?
You know, that's a real possibility. I don't know that that will happen in the very short term, but in the longer term, that very much could happen. And it does reflect a couple of important things. One is that the involvement of evangelicals in politics has led to a maturation, an understanding of how the political process works. Also, the success of evangelicals in spreading their religious perspective in America at large, and in fact in the world at large, has produced a larger but more diverse community, a religious community. And the larger and more diverse a community is, the more likely there are to be different perspectives and disagreements. And finally, of course, all of us operate in the broader political context, and that context is shifting. We have new issues arising, new leaders arising, and you know where exactly evangelicals will fit in is a matter of some debate.
Two quick final questions. Was the Reverend Jerry Falwell able to draw support from outside the evangelical and fundamentalist community?
Yes, he was. In the moral majority, the primary support was among evangelicals and fundamentalists, but he also made some significant inroads among conservative Catholics who were also upset about many of the same issues. It developed some support among mainline Protestants and also even among Orthodox Jews and non-Christians of various sorts. And perhaps he didn't always get as much support from outside the evangelical community as he would like, but he received much more support than many people thought he would.
And then with less than a minute, John, what will be the religious and political legacy of the Reverend Jerry Falwell?
Well, I think in the political world, the involvement of evangelicals and conservative Christians in national politics is a very important legacy. That's, I think, largely positive, although, of course, it does have a bit of controversy associated with it. But also Reverend Falwell will be remembered for the religious institutions that he founded, his church and his college, which may be important institutions many generations from now.
Pewforum.org is the website address for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. Pewforum.org. John Green is Senior Fellow in Religion and American Politics for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, based in D.C. John, thank you for joining us again and making time for us during your busy schedule.
You are very welcome.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time talking about, we're going to try and get through all of them, but you know there are so many of these guys. On both the Democratic and the Republican side, there are so many of them. I think we're now talking about in excess of 20 candidates, maybe. The Republican and Democratic presidential candidates, as they stand even this far out from the primary season, much less the 2008 presidential elections. Dr. James Berkey will be our guest, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin. After that conversation in the 5 o'clock hour, we'll do some audio open lines, some brief audio open lines. We'll review an Ascension sermon preached this Sunday morning by Dr. Charles Geeshan at Kramer Chapel on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary. And we'll close out today's program with Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Remember what we do. We cull some audio from this week's Issues Etc., break it down into nice, digestible sound bites. We play them for you, and then we ask you to call in and vote for your Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's coming up in about 1 hour here on Issues Etc.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The next broadcast of Law and Gospel is Open Line, during which you may phone in with any question or comment. There is no set agenda, although we will be responding to emails in between calls received. You do not need to restrict yourself to addressing what we spoke of in recent programs, but may choose your own topic.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The recent Supreme Court decision to uphold a federal law banning partial birth abortion means nothing if it isn't enforced. That was the message on Capitol Hill yesterday. A number of groups want the U.S. Attorney General to publicly share strategies that the Department of Justice has put into place to guarantee the rule of law is honored. Josh Montez reports.
It's been a month since the Department of Justice defeated Planned Parenthood in a landmark Supreme Court ruling upholding the Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003. Now the question is, how will it be enforced? No one knows for sure. In a letter to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Paul Shank of the National Pro-Life Action Center, along with other advocates for the preborn, warned without aggressive federal enforcement, partial birth abortions will continue.
While today, partial birth abortions are illegal in the United States, they continue in places like New Jersey and Kansas. And the question is, how will the law be enforced? And when will the penalties apply?
Pat Mahoney with the Christian Defense Coalition says the DOJ needs to enforce the ban soon because innocent lives hang in the balance.
It could be months and maybe over a year if there is not an aggressive move by the people of faith, the American public, to see that this ban is actually enforced.
Dave Gardner with National Black Pro-Life Union is among those asking how and when the law will be applied.
We're just saying that since it is a crime, we want to know how is it going to be enforced and what are the consequences for anyone still doing this procedure.
No word from Planned Parenthood or the DOJ. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
When the partial birth abortion ban of 2003 was signed into law by President Bush, it was immediately challenged in court by pro-abortion groups. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
In a week-long series about the threat of Islamofascism to our families and to our future, Focus on the Family presents a discussion between Dr. James Dobson and Dr. Michael Youssef that you don't want to miss. In the face of great danger, there is hope for America. Find out more on the next Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. Regular guest pastor John Pless is the author of our Book of the Month for May titled Word, God Speaks to Us. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or you can read an excerpt of this Bible study on our website, issuesetc.org. What's the relationship between the Word of God and the work of the Holy Spirit? Find out with Word, God Speaks to Us, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May.
One has to ask the atheist, well, where did all this come from? And he would back up to the Big Bang and to this story of evolution, for which, of course, there is no real solid evidence. And no atheist was there at the beginning to observe it. So he is on just as shaky a ground as he accuses a Christian of being on. There were no atheists or evolutionists back when things began to back up their version of how the Earth and the universe came to be.
Well, that's a caller to the program, Andy from Kirkwood, asking a good question that you might pose to atheists. It's one of our candidates for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We'll be playing that in about an hour here on Issues Etc. Your chance to vote for that one coming up in an hour. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. One of the things that was, this was really a thrill to be able to meet Aaron Bodie recently at the LCMS World Relief. They had a conference on mercy here in St. Louis. We were broadcasting live. Got a chance to meet her and interview her and listen a little bit to a couple of the tracks of this CD that she produced along with the Temba Girls from South Africa. The CD is called The Temba Girls with the Aaron Bodie Group. Now, you can find out all about this CD by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You'll get the CD if you make a gift of $25 or more to LCMS World Relief. They're going to send this to you. It's marvelous. It's a marvelous, mostly beautifully performed hymns with Aaron Bodie's group and the Temba Girls Choir. The sound must be heard to be believed. The one that we played with her when we interviewed her was one that her mother had taught her when she was just a little girl. It's called the Temba Girls Choir with the Aaron Bodie Group. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, or you can call and ask about this CD. The proceeds go to the Temba Girls and to relief efforts there in South Africa. 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. Well, for the remainder of this hour, Dr. James Berkey is our guest. We're going to be talking with him about the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates. Yes, I know it's early. Yes, I know that just the primary season is still months and months away. But they're going to be sooner than ever, and these things apparently will be decided much earlier in this presidential cycle than ever before. And there's no shortage of candidates, is there? Hopefuls out there. Dr. James Berkey is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and co-founder of Americans for Responsibility in Washington, D.C. Dr. Berkey, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Todd, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Which Republican and Democratic candidates have surprised you the most lately?
On the Republican side, I've got to say Rudy Giuliani. From the beginning, my thought was that a guy like Giuliani, who is pro-choice from I lived in New York City. It's a very, very liberal city. I think 85% of New Yorkers self-identify as Democrats and liberals. And that somebody with that track record has no chance in nationwide primaries where you've got to appeal to the base. Pro-abortion, favor of gay marriage, very liberal on social issues that conservatives and evangelicals have thought so critical for so long. Thought he had no chance, and especially once we got into the debates and other candidates had a chance to hit him on this, that he'd sink quickly. And yet what we found here after the most recent debate even is that it seems that Giuliani's plan of counting on conservatives being really dispirited, conservatives really looking pragmatically at opponents like Hillary, after an off year for Republicans in Congress, and in the middle of a war, that Republicans would turn his plan, of course, that Republicans would turn to national security and allow that to trump abortion as an issue. He's been spot on that prediction so far, and that's really surprised me. That surprised me.
What about the Democratic candidates? Have there been any surprises for you there?
I've seen little that has surprised me beyond Barack Obama's resilience. He had a little surge against Hillary. He's been polling at low 20s in the polls. That's surprising. It's surprising to me that he's had the staying power that he has so far, given that he's so inexperienced, and that he's been able to raise the money that he's been able to raise.
Would Rudolph Giuliani have the chance with primary voters, which tend to be the core voters of any party? Would he have that chance with GOP primary voters were it not for his involvement in not only New York City's recovery, but more than that, really, the events of 9/11?
Oh, he's counting on it, isn't he? He's counting on 9/11, and 9/11 seems to trump everything. He, in the last debate, came right out with 9/11 as an issue. And I guess what surprised me also is that he's been really frank about his abortion, positions, and he's not... kind of obfuscated on that too much. So absolutely, 9/11 has trumped everything on this, and he's made some smart moves here.
What in the world is behind Barack Obama's meteoric rise, but then also, as you say, pretty astonishing staying power against what is now a D.C. and a national institution, the person considered his primary opponent for the primaries, Hillary Clinton?
Right. Obviously, he's the anti-Hillary, and Barack Obama has been able to count on that. There's a lot of, there's Clinton fatigue in the country. In the New York Times this morning, really interesting piece looking at, and I think it's important to do this, looking at what all of the candidates are not saying. For John McCain, there's no mention of McCain-Feingold. John McCain, who was so crucial in building this immigration reform package that actually passed today, doesn't talk much about it. And we're not going to see his face in the pictures because the amnesty issue is something that is problematic for some conservatives in the party and primary voters. For Democrats, curiously enough, I think it's Hillary. Now I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, and it's curious to find that there are a good number of Democrats who do have Hillary fatigue. And it's not just the pragmatism, the fear that she can't win. She certainly does have high and sustained negatives. I think that's a part of it. I think another part of Obama's staying power is America's antipathy to aristocracy. And we hear more and more commentators talking about or calling for a conversation. Nick Kristof did this in the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorialist in the Times recently, calling for a discussion about whether or not it's a wise thing for us to go 3 decades nearly, potentially, with Bush or Clinton in the White House. So I think that has a lot to do with Obama's staying power, for lack of really an alternative to Hillary that's really attractive. John Edwards has been fading a little bit here. He passed himself off as the anti-war candidate, but he's had some bad PR in the past few weeks.
Okay, we talked recently with our listeners about Fred Thompson because it was being speculated he was making noises like he was going to run.
Yes.
And we were surprised by our listeners' response to Fred Thompson. They just thought it was a great idea. They were very excited about it. They find him appealing. How do you explain this?
Well, it's easy to explain in that if you look at the three GOP frontrunners right now, they are all somewhat flawed in the eyes, at least, of the social conservative base or and the economic conservative base in the party. John McCain, again, he's got a pretty consistent and steady track record as a conservative. He's, of the three frontrunners, certainly the most conservative on social issues and even on economic issues, on fiscal responsibility. Yet here in Washington, D.C. this week, meeting with an important lobbyist, he said, you know, I really like John McCain. Got to admire a guy who's a war hero who suffered for his country all those years, and he's a good, strong conservative, but you never know where he's going to go. And we saw that with McCain-Feingold, his willingness to kind of buck the party on immigration and other issues like that. Mitt Romney, of course, is, look at what he's not talking about. The big elephant in the room is his Mormon faith. Our evangelicals going to have a problem with that once the national discussion emerges about Mormonism and what it is. And also, he was governor of Massachusetts. Now he can claim that I can win in a blue state, but Massachusetts has been pilloried for a long time as Taxachusetts, as grand central station of liberalism in the United States. And as one newspaper this morning asked, well, he was governor of Massachusetts. What was he doing there in the first place? And then, of course, Giuliani, who's got those what some would consider extremely liberal social issues that are going to millstone around his neck. So conservatives are looking for a popular, viable conservative in that kind of Reagan, that Reagan cloth. And Fred Thompson, who's got more than one attribute that seems to parallel Ronald Reagan. Not only his conservative values and his conservative voting record, but his kind of acting resume.
Dr. James Berkey is our guest, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin, co-founder of Americans for Responsibility in Washington, D.C. We're talking about Republican and Democratic presidential candidates during this half hour of Issues Etc. Coming up here in about 15 minutes, we'll be reviewing a sermon preached this morning on this Ascension Day by Dr. Charles Geeshan at the Kramer Chapel at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Our call-in number is 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727, or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Berkey, your former governor, Tommy Thompson, he's at least one of the many in the GOP crowd. What do you make of him?
Oh, well, Tommy Thompson is He's a good guy. He was an effective governor in Wisconsin, but like many of those second-tier candidates, he really has little chance of going anywhere. He's got a consistently conservative voting record, was a very popular governor in Wisconsin. But the fact that so many conservatives are turning to another Thompson, Fred Thompson, tells us that he's just not got a chance to go anywhere. He's not been able to raise any money. He's been camping out in Iowa every single week for months now. And yet he's barely been able to raise enough money to even sustain his organization in Iowa. So, unfortunately for Wisconsinites, I don't think he's got much of a chance. We're going to have to look to another Thompson.
Which of the second tier, as you call them, second tier Republican candidates, has the best chance of being what they call the dark horse, to move up into the upper tier, perhaps unexpectedly?
That's a tough one. I would have to give the edge to, you got a couple of candidates. One would be Sam Brownback, senator from Kansas, who's a good man, very respected in the party. I think even respected on the other side of the aisle. Very consistent conservative on social and even fiscal issues. On the Senate side of the aisle, I'd take a look at Sam Brownback. On the another candidate I would take a look at would be Duncan Hunter, the California Republican from the House of Representatives, who's got a long track record of leadership in the House. Again, consistently conservative on the issues that the base look towards. He's also, if we watch the debates, he's a really sharp guy. He's very knowledgeable, very experienced, and I think comes across well on television. So that might play to his benefit. He's also from California, which will appeal to pragmatic Republicans who are looking for somebody who can draw votes in a blue state.
Do any of the second-tier Democratic candidates that we have out there now, do they have dark horse potential?
Well, the dark horse on the Democratic side is Al Gore, who hasn't really declared his intention to run or his interest in running. But if we take a look at these national polls that consistently include Fred Thompson on the Republican side and Al Gore on the Democratic side, they're both polling about 10%, which is pretty significant when you consider the people who have declared, Dodd and Joe Biden and Bill Richardson and others, are in the low single digits at best, even in some of the primary states where they're camping out and spending their money.
Are the Democratic second tiers hoping for, are they running not so much because they, I mean, they, all of them want to be president, obviously, but are they in there now for the primary season hoping to be picked up as a vice presidential pick?
Sure, and that's typically the way it works, or it has worked that way in the past. The Democratic second-tier candidates, like Joe Biden, for example. Joe Biden appeared on Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago with Tim Russert, and he's asked the question, what would you think about serving in a Hillary Clinton administration or a Barack Obama administration? And he didn't dismiss the idea outright. I think he'd be, and he probably would be a fine Secretary of State candidate or a national security advisor. He's very experienced in foreign affairs issues. There may be some who are also clinging to the hope that world events might reshape the debate a little bit. And I'll use Joe Biden again as another example, because Biden has pitched a plan in opposition to the Democratic leadership, who have been calling for a withdrawal from Iraq. He's been promoting his own plan, which is a partition of Iraq into Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish segments. If events turned a certain way in Iraq, who knows? Maybe that would shift the debate on Iraq, which is, again, the central issue in this campaign. So I think you do have some true believers in that pack, but by and large, these fellows have got to know that they're playing for administration positions, possible vice presidential nominations also.
Does an outside-the-beltway candidate have an advantage over, say, in the case of the current senators or representatives running?
Yes, absolutely. In this climate in particular, if Beltway means Congress and President Bush, all we've got to take a look at, all we've got to do is take a look at these historically low presidential and congressional approval ratings. I noted it was just a couple of hours ago that the Senate finally reached agreement on an immigration reform package. I don't know that would have happened had it not been for polls last week that show that Congress actually has an approval rating that is lower than the president. And the president's got the second lowest approval rating in the history of modern polling. These guys know that they're very unpopular and they need to get some things done. So it's interesting to see them actually work together in a bipartisan way on immigration. So, yes, I think an outside the Beltway candidate has a better chance, which is why you've got guys like Giuliani and Romney, or Giuliani in particular, I think, leading on the Republican side. Barack Obama, who's really not tainted with being a Washington insider, even though he's been in the Senate for a couple of years and very inexperienced, polling as well as he is. So, yes, absolutely.
What are the issues, Democratic and Republican, respectively, that are driving the candidates? What are the top issues?
It's obvious right now that it's all war. Again, I'm in Washington right now and with some students from Concordia University, Wisconsin. We've taken a tour of the Capitol and sat in on the House floor. And a couple of days ago, we're in the House chamber watching a procedural vote on an issue completely unrelated to the war. They take the roll call. The congressmen disperse, and then they launch right into an entire afternoon of speech after speech after speech having to do with Iraq. Iraq is driving all of this. I think if it were not for what was happening in Iraq, a war on terror, we would not see Rudy Giuliani getting the kind of support he is. And certainly Iraq is driving the debate on the other side of the aisle, too. And it's going to continue to drive it. So, it's you know, at this point, to say that there's a front runner on either side is problematic because we don't know how this war is going to look in the fall. If the surge works, I think John McCain is the one who benefits from that. If there's some progress on the surge front, if it doesn't, you've got Democrats, perhaps John Edwards, who's been most vocally opposed to the war, who benefit, and I think substantially so.
Two questions on the primary system, one having to do with Giuliani. If Giuliani, pro-choice Republican candidate, is able to win the GOP nomination in this primary season, what will that mean for the future of GOP politics, especially presidential politics?
That's an interesting question. And I tend to think that it may mean defeat in the presidential election. We already see talk in Washington here among some about who's going to be the candidate in 2012. Should we get that that more liberal candidate who winds up losing in 2008? One insider here suggested that, there's a part of me that'd like to see him, win in 2008 and take the country down in flames so that we can get a true conservative back in 2012. On the other hand, if Giuliani were to win the nomination, I think we would certainly see him choose a very socially conservative running mate. Presidential candidates have a long history of doing that, of going into different regions and picking someone of at the opposite end of the party to bring some unity back together. And remember, again, at the core of all of this, I think we're going to find pragmatism. People on both sides of the aisle like to win. And fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, particularly on life issues, I think you're going to find a lot of Republicans that would rally around Rudy Giuliani. Because he's a Republican, and he's been able to diffuse the life issue enough by promising to appoint conservative justices to the Supreme Court, which is really all a president can do. And who knows? Maybe we'll just go with their pragmatic instincts there.
The entire primary season is in the process of kind of being front loaded. It used to be Iowa and New Hampshire. That were, of course, the big deciders. They were the threshold events. And now as more states are moving farther and farther up on the calendar in their primary caucus seasons, is this perhaps one of the last times we see the candidates spending so much time in Iowa and New Hampshire exclusively going into a primary season?
Todd, I don't know that that's going to be the case. Certainly this primary season is front-loaded, and there is still an advantage, even if it's only a week in advance, to coming out ahead in Iowa and New Hampshire before you head into this nearly 20-state primary across the country as everything becomes front-loaded. I also think the things that become so problematic with this primary system as more and more states move up, which saw Florida move up into January with its primary, that I think we're finally going, as we saw, you know, in the wake of 2000 election, for example, with voting and voting machines and some of those voting problems, finally there was a nationwide call to come up with some kind of solution, electronic voting machines and so on. In that same vein, I think after this primary season, it's gotten so out of hand. So much money spent. Candidates who do not enter the primary season 18 months in advance and raise $50 million have no chance of competing in 20 states within a period of a couple of weeks. So therefore, there are going to be strong calls for reforming the primary system. And I think those reforms will result in something that pushes the primaries back and still preferences Iowa, New Hampshire. My prediction for now.
Our time is short. We haven't mentioned the name of Newt Gingrich. 10 seconds of your thoughts on another guy who hasn't announced, but a lot of people would like to see him do it. Newt Gingrich.
Oh, you know, I like Newt's ideas, but I don't think he's got any chance. He's got too much personal baggage. I think he's a good guy whose time has already come and gone.
Tell us about this organization that you and your colleague at Concordia University, Wisconsin, Dr. Jeff Walls, founded, called Americans for Responsibility in Washington.
Yes, ResponsibilityPAC.org. You can check out our website, a number of issues. We are primarily focused on bipartisan cooperation. Dr. Jeff Walls, Democrat, myself, a Republican, focusing on the areas where we can come together for national solutions, particularly on issues like fiscal responsibility. We met this week here in Washington with the Comptroller General of the U.S., David Walker, who pointed to the fiscal tsunami, the crisis that we're facing here. And our central hope here is to model that kind of bipartisanship that will pull Americans together on major crises that we're facing, this, entitlement reform, Social Security reform, and we're glad to see immigration happening today. So check out our website, responsibilitypac.org, for more information.
Dr. James Berkey is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and co-founder of Americans for Responsibility in Washington. It's responsibilitypac.org is the website address. You can visit it tonight, responsibilitypac.org. Thanks for being our guest.
Appreciate it.
Well, the third hour is going to be busy. We're going to review an Ascension sermon preached this morning by Dr. Charles Geeshan at Kramer Chapel at the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. This one's right off the presses. Hours old. We'll hear what he has to say about the ascension of Jesus Christ. And then after that sermon review, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week with you. That means we're going to play four sound bites from this week's Issues Etc. audio. As usual, we found our callers to be a very fruitful source. We actually had three callers in the running for our eventual four candidates. Only one made the cut, and you've already heard the soundbite. You'll hear it again in about half hour here, and you can vote for it or the other soundbites that we have culled from our audio for your Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's coming up here in a half hour. When we come back, a sermon review. Dr. Charles Geeshan is a regular guest on the program. You've heard him talk about many things as a guest here. When we come back, you'll hear him preaching about the ascension of Jesus Christ. We always invite your questions and your comments and your reaction as well. And here are the phone numbers for this last hour, both the sermon review and Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or 505-7850. A sermon review right after this.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues Etc.